stories that are not obviously inconsistent, at least if we bracket much of what we know, but that something is imaginable in this sense is no test for its possibility. And then he continues, he says, and this is what's bluntly put, the Brain in a Vat case is a fairy tale on a par with that of Sleeping Beauty. Is it possible for a princess to sleep for 100 years until awakened with a kiss? Don't ask. It's magic. Is it really possible to replicate the extraordinarily complex electrochemical brain activity going on in me right now by sticking electrodes in my cortex? Who knows? It's certainly not possible today. So essentially, he continues, fairy tale imaginings are not grounds for doubt in any context. If taking them seriously is a precondition for engaging in Cartesian epistemology, so much the worse for Cartesian epistemology.
Effectively, although it's obviously more complex than this, there is a component of pointing out the absurdity in the skeptical claims being made.
Yeah.
And that absurdity based upon the fact that, like, as Wittgenstein said, you know, paraphrasing, I'm like, you know, I can doubt that I have a brain. I haven't seen my brain. I haven't physically touched it.
Yeah.
But like, no one's ever, I've never been given a reason to think I'm actually brainless.
Yeah.
In the literal sense of the word. Not yeah. Just being dumb sometimes.
Yeah. No, it would be, it would be interesting if someone had a reason, like what would a reason for doubting that you have a brain look like? Like what would, and this is the other thing too, if someone produces a reason, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's justified. You could have a kind of delusion, which is something that Wittgenstein says, of mental disturbance.
You know, and I think that they use an interesting term was used in the passage here, which is bracketing. Like it's like you can like think about these things if you bracket out all other stuff. But just as William said there, they kind of bracket out all other knowledge, facts, basically mm-hmm. basic reality about the situation, things you know. And you can say like, oh, well, if we ignore everything else, magic stuff happens.
Yeah.
And it's like, sure.
Yeah.
Like that's a, like if that's what you want to do on epistemic level, like you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really doing all that much.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, I really like this too, because Williams does, I think, implicitly recognize that the Cartesian skeptical situation is not actually one that Descartes himself would have. So in the Meditations on First Philosophy, Descartes is not actually subscribing to the evil demon situation. It's more or less a sketched out scenario to arrive at certain knowledge, right? He's not committed to this belief, but it's more or less a pragmatic tool. And I think Williams understands that when he says that, you know, when we go into our philosophy studies, we put on these artificial scenarios, but we know that they're artificial. When we leave them like a carpenter leaves a hammer in their workshop, you know?
You know, I think you're absolutely right. And it's an interesting, as two philosophy students and people who have kind of been in this world for a little bit, that the radical skepticism, much like, it's kind of similar, and I think in a lot of ways, to moral skepticism, or my mind is blanking.
like a moral relativism?
Yeah, moral relativism, Where what I think a lot of people encounter is an argument that appears and to be very convincing, a structure that appears very convincing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually a true or a good argument.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's very enticing or simple to say, hey, you dream all the time. This could be a dream.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how do you know? How can you be sure? And it's very, you know, that's a very, it's an easy move to get caught up in, despite the fact that there's no reason to think it's the case.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, every time that I've encountered the Cartesian skeptical problem as it's asserted as a skeptical problem, my usual way of dismissing it is to think back to my philosophy 100 class where I learned about the burden of proof. And so if someone says something like, we could be dreaming, or you could be a brain in a vat, that's a possibility. It's a very difficult possibility to prove, but it sounds like you're making that claim. And if you're the one making that claim, I would be really interested to hear why you think that we are in a dream, or we are, I am a brain in a vat. What is your argument for saying that? And this is to reject the hasty acceptance of, oh, well, that's a plausible picture. I will subscribe to that picture. No, that's actually a very difficult picture to prove, and that is grounds for not accepting it immediately.
Yeah, I think people get lost up at, like, or get caught up in a difference between taking something like a hypothetical or like a tool, mm-hmm. like Descartes did, like, and that's always a really interesting example, because, you know, Descartes sort of we might call him the poster boy, a lot of this radical skepticism, even though he himself was not a radical skeptic.
Yeah.
Like, obviously he had some very skeptical bents, but he clearly was using it more as a tool to get to certain knowledge, whatever that, you know, looked like for him.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really interesting that, like, people always go to that, and it's like, he didn't actually accept this argument.
Yeah.
Like, this is not, and it's different. It's like, there's a difference between something being a tool and something being a hypothetical and actually making a proposition or a claim about the world. And I think people get these really confused sometimes, you know, as of late, I think the version of this that I'm like, I encounter the most is people, including a lot of really smart people, at least through what they put out social media or just in the media more generally, is the simulation thing, right? We're in a simulation. Elon Musk thinks we're in a simulation. Mm-hmm. So-and-so person thinks we're in a simulation. And again, it's a question of, like, you know, it generally goes back to, oh, well, computers are very advanced. Mm. Tech could be very advanced. It's possible it could be this way.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, but there's no reason to think that it's the case.
Yeah.
Right? Like, organisms are very advanced. Why isn't the universe actually like one giant living organism? That is also entirely possible.
The Stoics thought that.
Yeah, like,
the cosmos is a one being, yeah.
But there's the same level of, like, background buttressing mm-hmm. there. And it's fine to muse about that. But again, when it comes down to, you know, finding some sort of epistemic ground, like, it comes back to this simple thing that we're talking about here, which is, like, you need to give reasons for why you think something is the case.
Yeah.
Or not the case.
Yeah, you need grounds for you need grounds for any belief that you have like that. Or even if you, like, I think the important thing that, the interesting thing with Wittgenstein is, let's say someone says, we're in a simulation, and I have an argument for it. Here's the thing. We're not all chin-stroking philosophers, you know? That's grounds for being like, you're, like, that's unusual. That, are you sure that, like, are you sure you're okay if you think that you can, you know, you're in a simulation and so you can walk through walls, or you're in a simulation so you can, like, you know, glitch to the other side of the earth or something like that.
No clip out of here.
Yeah, you can no clip and, like, go to the back rooms or something, you know. It's like, if you actually believe that, even if you have grounds for believing it, you have arguments or evidence or whatever, you don't live in a world where that is entertainable.
Yeah.
You know, and this goes to the other thing that I was thinking about. I'm kind of glad that you brought up the contemporary situation of radical skepticism. It's that there's something that Arendt mentions about Cartesian skepticism, and it's that, I mean, we've always kind of had situations that we can pose to ourselves where, you know, we can doubt whether the world is, just a dream or something like that. And she makes this really interesting point that, you know, even when you read Cicero, he is entertaining this idea that we're all in a dream. But the structure of that fairy tale is like, okay, well, you can wake up from it. You can wake up from a dream and realize, oh, wow, you know, I was in a dream. So it's not as radical a problem as you might think. But it's interesting that with Descartes posing a different picture, that modifies our picture of what we think a dream is. Like, you can't wake up from it somehow. Yeah, like, you can't wake up from the dream, whereas before, the picture provided a very different situation. Skepticism wasn't radical. You could wake up from the dream. I'm pointing that out to say that not only does radical skepticism have like a structural sort of, I guess, fault in it that you never really have grounds for it. It has a historical dimension. We pose different stories to ourselves and kind of like, you know, we scare ourselves with different, you know, now we have a simulation, whereas for Descartes, it was an evil demon. And these change each other. They have compounding.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. And you were listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show before a little bit of technical stuff happened. So we're going to try to get you back to that. But in the meantime, we can listen maybe to some birds. We're going to listen to the ruby-throated hummingbird.
This is Bird Note. It's late April in the Northeast. You've just stepped out for a breath of spring air and... Hey, what was that? A tiny bird just whizzed by like a bullet. There it is over by those scarlet flowers hovering. It's a hummingbird.
Hello
it
and welcome to the Canadian...
must be a ruby-throated hummingbird. The only hummingbird that nests in the eastern states. No wonder it buzzed you. You're wearing a red baseball cap. Must have thought you were a really prized flower. Most ruby-throated hummingbirds spend the winter in Central America. By March, some males are already returning to the southeast, but it's well into April before they reach the northern states. Female hummingbirds arrive a couple weeks later, after the males have staked out breeding territories. Males greet females with a remarkable aerial performance, flying back and forth in a perfect arc, like a pendulum suspended on an invisible wire, and accompanied by buzzing wings and cricket-like chirps. So fill up the hummingbird feeder, put on a red hat or jacket, and listen for a hummingbird coming your way. Learn what hummingbird might visit your yard when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
I kept saying it, and Bertrand Russell just like tearing out cabinet drawers, and there's no hippopotamus in here, but Wittgenstein is making a different point than asserting that a hippopotamus is in this room. Him saying hippopotamus in this room, again, makes sense independent of whether it's true or false, right? In Wittgenstein's language, and I think he's being a bit I think he's like using the word fact as a piece of jargon in his own system, but for him a fact doesn't have to be true or false, right? A fact just pictures the world in a certain way.
A fact doesn't have to be true or false in the sense of, like, we think of facts today as like, when we talk, we're living in this post-fact world, it's going to be, people are talking about like the people kind of use fact and truth synonymously.
Yeah.
Whereas Wittgenstein is saying, no, a fact is something that can have a truth value attributed to it.
Exactly. But you understand.
We're not actually concerned with the truth value.
Not yet, at least. Yeah. because not until we have, that's not until we have a truth function, right? And the point that Wittgenstein is pointing up with that is that, again, I'm being, you know, not, I hope I'm not being repetitive, but Wittgenstein is also repetitive in this way. He is saying, look, you understand what a hippopotamus is in this room means before you know the truth or falsity. Like, look at Bertrand Russell. He's pulling out his drawer cabinets and throwing the curtains open. He understands how to go about verifying this proposition. So he understands the fact, right? And the fact depicts, as Wittgenstein's picture goes, a proposition depicts a state of affair. It depicts a fact. States of affairs are a common combination to make facts, and then those facts are like, or a proposition is like a picture that shows what the world would have to be like if this proposition were true, right? So you can understand what I mean when I was painting this picture earlier of states of objects and their states of affairs go down, right? They combine kind of the non-real sort of abstract objects and relate them in ways that they can only be real, right? Whereas the picture goes upward, because you can only get the truth or falsity of this picture by comparing it to the world, right? And at every stage that you need to determine the truth or falsity of something, you are always comparing it to the world. So like later on when he's talking about not just like pictures and facts, so like the hippopotamus is in the room, but any kind of complicated proposition, you're always checking it against the world for its truth or falsity. Whereas the sense is always a function of whether certain things make sense to combine, right? This is actually, this slipped my mind a little bit, but it's actually really important to bring up, because we were talking about nonsense propositions before. One of the important things for Wittgenstein is that objects can only combine in certain combinations, right? So you can't have a monochromatic blue and red ball, right? You can't have a four-sided triangle, right? You can't have a frozen flame. You can't have a, you know, you can't, I'm trying to think of like, so like, let's just like take some object, like you get it, right? Objects only, there's only a certain combination of objects that are possible, right? So blue, red can't combine together, but blue triangle can, right? This landscape that gets carved out of all the possible combination of objects, Wittgenstein would call logical form, right? That's like the space within which sense is possible.
Yeah, logical form is all the basically the full set of the way in which objects can actually connect with each other.
Exactly, yeah.
And that, whether or not they're actually part of anything that's in reality or whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
it is literally just the basically symbolic structure.
Exactly, yeah. It's the symbolic structure that prefigures all the possibilities of sense, right? And it's for this reason that, again, that downward motion of language makes sense prior to its comparison with the world for its truth or falsity. There are certain combinations of language that make sense. Now, just like how objects come together in a state of affairs to make sense, states of affairs come together in facts to make sense. Certain states of affairs don't make sense to combine, right? So like, say you throw wood into a fire and it doesn't get consumed. Or, well, yeah, like that fact of it persisting in its being wood does not make sense in relation to this other fact, right? So you always have this combinatorial, the combinatorial possibilities that carve out logical form are what give things sense, prior to their being verified against the world for their truth or falsity. And that works all the way up. So you can see, because we've moved from, okay, well, objects combine in states of affairs combine in facts. Okay, well, certain facts are going to relate into like elementary propositions and as far as names go. And then later on, only certain names will make sense to combine. And then that's where you start getting into like, you know, analyzing ordinary language and stuff like that. So you can see that this combinatorial, the way that the constituents of language combine in order to make sense of language prior to its being verified as true or false runs all the way up. This is why I say that if you understand the relation between objects and states of affairs, then you can get a foothold on, if you can wade through Wittgenstein's terse, cryptic prose, then you can you kind of have the blueprint for understanding Wittgenstein. It's quite simple, actually. If the logical atomists, if one of the errors that they fall into is that they think that the items of logic are these atomic facts or these things that come together and combine, the error that they make is that the relation between themselves is a thing, right? So if the cat is on the mat, for a logical atomist, there would be three items there: cat, and then their relation, on, and mat. Wittgenstein solves this by relying on this combinatorial possibility, right? It's the way that things can and cannot relate to each other that knocks out that third item, right? Because there's nothing that's actually mediating their relationship except for the sense and nonsense of their combining, right? And that's the way that he solves Russell's paradox, essentially.
The combination in that is the cat is on the mat, and the connector on isn't like a thing independent of itself, right? Like people want to split up, you know, a statement and be like, okay, there's all these little parts. And it's like, again, Wittgenstein's saying like, look, the fact is that these things are true, like, together, right? And taking them apart, like, drains them effectively of their sensibility.
Yeah, well, you know what it does is it produces metaphysics. That's what Wittgenstein... It produces the problems of philosophy, because now you can ask, well, what is the nature of on-ness? With or in, you know? You have all of these essential, like, metaphysical entities that you can start investigating, but that's to misunderstand the logic of language.
It's, you know, another example is like going back, and this is like, on some level, I think Wittgenstein is dealing with, well, it's a whole problem of philosophy, but it's, you know, a problem of, you know, Platonic forms and stuff like that on some level. It's like, we go back to object triangle, right? Like we were saying before, if you just say triangle, then it's like, well, what triangle? Triangle, okay, triangle-ness, this triangle that's not actually... And there's no reference, whereas Wittgenstein's, you know, point is that, look, these things are always going to be in a logical web, and they're always going to be together, and we're trying to rip them apart. They're going to be together in, like, sets of possibilities, right? But trying to split those sets of possibilities apart leads you, like you're saying, into metaphysics, into nonsense, where suddenly you're just going, no, it's not the top of the building is a triangle, or it's not that a triangle has three sides, or it's not that, you know, a hypotenuse or you can't just be like, oh, triangle. No. Right now we're just talking about triangle. It's like that doesn't actually mean anything.
Yeah. Well, if you think of it's interesting, I guess because we're almost at the end of this episode, but if you think about the origin in the ancient schools of philosophy starts in wonder, just standing in front of something and kind of gazing at it and contemplating it. The Greeks call it thaumatzein. Wow, triangle, or the world, you know? So it makes a lot of sense that kind of experience, that kind of philosophical experience, would lead philosophers down the kind of project that they'd have, because their experience is something beyond words, right? You still can have these experiences, like philosophers do it all the time. I think even in our day-to-day, we do have experiences like, wow, you know, you're walking along and you just see, I don't know, but there's things we admire in a non...
Well, I think...
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, I think the best example of this, probably for Wittgenstein and Lepo's school, would be ethics and morality. Right, like obviously ethics, morality on some level is a thing that we encounter in like forms of life, for back to Black, but I was saying that. Wittgenstein's point would be, I'm getting tricky, it's actually not something that you can make true or false statements about.
Right.
And the error
is that we think we can, so we invent this science called ethics, and then we go and try and create all these things, but that's nonsense.
Yeah, it's basically like it's just all doesn't... It doesn't. None of it actually works. None of it actually works within the framework of, Werkle Kleid.
Yeah, it doesn't even work whether you're going real Atat or Werkle Kleid. Well, real Atat, because you can see, like, that's the whole thing, is the mystical does show itself in the world. You just can't put it in terms of true or false, or in terms of existence and non-existence, because there's only existence in front of you. You can't even use words to construct a non-existent state of, or a non-existent fact of like this particular thing. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon. I've been joined by Hale. Thank you for listening.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.